This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Gail Averes, a postdoctoral research fellow of the Telethon Kids Institute, the University of Western Australia in Perth. Gail recently co-authored a paper in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, investigating associations between birth order and autism diagnostic phenotypes. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with the rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Gail, thank you for joining me. Can you start by introducing yourself?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. So as you mentioned, my name's Gail Alvarez. I'm a scientist that specialises in autism research. I work in Perth, which is in the west coast of Australia. So I just want to acknowledge elders past and present and emerging for their generosity and wisdom in the research we conduct at Telethon Kids, and just to extend my respect to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people who may be listening to this. And also just as a quick note that as we talk about autism research, I might use my language interchangeably between person first and identity first language. So I might say individual on the autism spectrum, or I might say autistic person or autistic adult. And just to acknowledge that people have different perspectives about language use about autism, and that there isn't really a preferred term for everyone, but just to be upfront that that's the language I'll use. But thank you very much for having me.
And how did you become interested in child and adolescent mental health, and in particular, autism research?
Yeah, so I did my PhD in mental health research, or in psychiatry, at the University of Sydney a little while ago. And I was really focusing on social anxiety disorder research in young people, particularly like biological mechanisms that contribute to the development of mental health conditions. Mm-hmm. And in the last kind of 5 to 6 years, in my postdoctoral research, really interested in understanding treatments as well as the mechanisms that contribute to autism. And now in my more recent work, specifically treatments or new therapies that can help identify mental health problems for children on the autism spectrum.
Gail, as mentioned in the intro, you recently co-authored a paper in the JCPP investigating birth order and autism. This was published in November 2020. Can you tell us how you carried out this important work, and also something about the findings?
Yeah, absolutely. I find it a fascinating study because there's, you know, been a lot of research in kind of the broader general population about these links between the order in which someone is born and actually a wide range of characteristics for those individuals. So, for example, one of the most heavily investigated areas are pretty well-established links between birth order and intelligence or educational attainment, and also some evidence of differences in sexual orientation by birth order. So it's really fascinating research. There's really, over the last decade or so, kind of an emerging body of evidence that showed that there was links between increasing birth order and the likelihood of getting a diagnosis of autism, so that there were increased odds of getting a diagnosis for autism in firstborn children or in laterborn children. And this was potentially reflecting differences in, for example, the reproductive histories of families or family decision making around having children. Mm. So what was really interesting to us is not so much the likelihood of whether or not an individual has a diagnosis of autism, but really the clinical presentation for individuals who already have a diagnosis. Because, of course, we understand that for any individual on the autism spectrum, there is a wide variety of abilities and challenges that can present in anyone at any one time. From a clinical perspective, it's really important to understand what are the mechanisms that contribute to that variability, because that helps us understand what supports we need to design to help that individual kind of achieve their goals and their potential. So from our perspective, we wanted to know, well, whether there was a link between birth order and differences in the phenotype or the clinical characteristics for individuals on the autism spectrum. And there was a little bit of research already done in this area, but in kind of smaller clinical samples. So we wanted to look at it in a very large sample. And luckily in Western Australia, we actually hold a very large resource called a diagnostic registry. So it's called the Western Australian Autism Diagnostic Registry. And it was established in 1999, so actually quite some time ago. And for a proportion of time, it was capturing data of every single person diagnosed with autism in the entire state. So as of this year, it has records of more than 6,000 individuals. So what we were able to do was to capture data through this registry and look at birth order, so the reported siblings for individuals at the time they were diagnosed, and then look at then that individual's diagnostic information. So not just whether or not they had a diagnosis, but actually the clinical features of that diagnosis. So their intelligence levels, their functional abilities, any other co-occurring symptoms. And so using this, we were able to do a series of statistical models to look at what was the differences in later born children relative to first born children. And we actually found this really interesting association that compared to children who were born first in the family, that later born children actually had increasing functional difficulties and decreasing IQ and increasing likelihood of intellectual disability. And this was also the case for children who didn't have siblings. So children who were the firstborn in their family but didn't have any other siblings at the time they were diagnosed. So they're really interesting findings. And the later you were born in a family, the more significant that difference in functional abilities was. So by the time we were getting to the third and the fourth born children, we were seeing differences in sort of 3 to 4 points on this adaptive functioning scale measure, which is what we would consider a clinically significant difference.
What are the implications of this then? What does it mean for clinicians? What does it mean for families?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the most important question we have to ask with some of these research studies is what does this actually clinically mean? And so there's a couple of different implications we have from this study. So for clinicians, it might imply that understanding the birth order of an individual and their family size might be really important when doing a diagnosis of an individual or considering a diagnostic evaluation for a child. And that it might also be important, particularly for clinicians, to be doing really detailed functional assessments for those individuals at the time of diagnosis, because this helps us understand the supports that that individual might need. The other implication is that this research might actually provide some evidence for the factors that might influence family decision-making. So for example, there was evidence in this study that children without siblings had poorer IQs and greater likelihood of intellectual disability compared to firstborn children with siblings. So this might indicate that children with greater functional challenges may then have an impact on family decision-making around having further children, or they might delay having further children to provide greater support for that child. So this might have some implications for things like providing supports for families at the time of diagnosis or increased supports. What this research does show for families is that there is an incredible variety or variability in clinical symptoms and functional abilities at the time of diagnosis. So the assumption is that when you get a diagnosis that you have very significant delays in lots of different areas. But actually, even in this very large cohort of, 5,500 children in this sample, there was a huge variety of intellectual abilities and of functional abilities across a number of different domains, like communication or daily living skills. And so this study really just provides one mechanism that explains some of this variability, but it also highlights that there's an incredible amount of variability for individuals on the spectrum.
So given that amount of variability, would you say that findings of this sort should influence families in terms of decision making around family planning, or is it too broad?
No, I mean, I think it just provides evidence that we should be doing more detailed assessments of ability levels. So then the measure we use, for example, in this study was a very broad interview or questionnaire that can be done. It's a very widely used measure. Other research in our team has shown that really we should be doing more strengths-based functional assessments that not only identify the difficulties that someone has, but also what are their relative strengths. How can we then help design supports and strategies that help highlight those strengths, while also providing supports for those things that somebody might find challenging? And so this is one study of a range of studies we've been using from this registry. All of them really imply that we should be doing really detailed functional assessments for individuals at diagnosis. So it's not as important what criteria someone meets to meet a diagnosis, but actually what are the challenges that they're exhibiting and how can we provide them best supports to help them achieve their potential.
It's very interesting. And are you planning any follow-up research to the birth order study?
Yeah, absolutely. So while this was an amazing and very large resource, we were limited in the types of information we had available based on what was collected using this registry. And in parallel work, I've been really heavily involved in a very large biobank that we've established. So we've called this the Australian Autism Biobank. And this is a really large study of children on the autism spectrum and their families. And within that study, we've done very detailed clinical interviews and assessments alongside also recruiting siblings not on the autism spectrum. So we have sort of data from more than 1,100 children on the spectrum plus siblings and children from the general population. So from this resource, we might be able to actually follow up this study and look and see if there are any further associations or more nuanced effects of birth order on clinical phenotypes in kids on the autism spectrum.
In other research, you've looked at novel treatments, including investigating the effects of intranasal oxytocin to treat social impairments in psychiatric disorders, including youth with autism. Can you tell us more about this work?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is sort of the area of research in which I sort of cut my teeth on when I first started working in research. And it's really around the potential effects of oxytocin in modulating, you know, human social behavior. So, I mean, oxytocin is something that I think probably a lot of people have heard of, or at least anecdotally might have heard about it, mainly because it's the hormone that's responsible for contractions during childbirth. And it's also responsible for lactation, so the milk reflex when you're breastfeeding. And because of this, it was actually developed synthetically as a compound to assist with lactation for people who are struggling with that. So we know there's actually decades of research that we know that giving this synthetic oxytocin is actually quite safe. And in parallel, there was all this really interesting animal work that was happening showing that oxytocin wasn't just the hormone responsible for these physiological functions. It actually seemed to have a really important role in attachment and social behavior, specifically things like mother-infant bonding or pair bonding or sexual attraction, and also how we understand and interpret social behaviors. So something called social cognition in humans. So there was a series of studies in the sort of the early 2000s that sort of indicated that oxytocin, when given to healthy volunteers, seemed to modulate or change aspects of social behavior. So the lab that I did my PhD in was one of the first groups in the world to really then make the next link to go, well, then potentially would this represent a novel treatment for people who have symptoms or conditions that have characteristic social difficulties as part of their phenotype. And so in our group, we were embarking across a range of different clinical trials, both in very acute short-term administration and then longer repeat administration, to see whether oxytocin could increase or change or improve aspects of social cognition and social behavior in a range of conditions like schizophrenia and autism. I was involved in coordinating an autism clinical trial, so for adolescents with a diagnosis of autism. We were also doing some studies in younger children, so sort of more preschool age children. The summary of that evidence seems to indicate that it's really complicated or it's quite mixed. So some of the clinical trials have shown some really interesting positive benefits in administration of oxytocin in changing parent ratings of social behaviors in children on the autism spectrum. Uh-huh. But then the trial that I was involved in showed a very, very strong placebo effect. So parents who thought their child had been receiving oxytocin in a double-blind study were actually the ones who were reporting the most significant benefits in the trials. So it seems to be a bit of a complicated story. This research is still very much underway, and there definitely seems to be much more nuanced studies coming out that showing complicated effects of how it may be working, but it's still a fascinating area and there's still lots and lots of trials still underway at the moment.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Are you involved with any other novel treatments or research or novel approaches to assessment?
Yeah. So a few years ago, I was working with some colleagues at the University of Western Australia, and we actually developed a game as a potential noveler approach for targeting social attention difficulties for children on the autism spectrum. So we started with the premise that some children with autism have difficulties attending to social information, so particularly faces, and this might underlie why they might find it difficult to understand what other people might be thinking or feeling. So we wanted just to test a hypothesis whether we could design an interactive game that was, you know, interesting for kids on the spectrum that would actually reinforce paying attention to faces, so these avatars that we had created. So it's sort of an interesting effect that doing this in a really short-term kind of 15-minute gameplay was enough to modulate eye contact when we were measuring this through eye tracking, but that when we gave the game for kids to play at home for a week, that it didn't really seem to do anything. Again, it comes from a line of research that I'm interested in is around what are the mechanisms that we think that contribute to difficulties for children on the autism spectrum. Then can we target or design interventions that might then address those mechanisms?
What other research areas are coming up for you?
Well, so I've just been awarded a grant to work on a anxiety type intervention for very young children on the autism spectrum. Again, this is a sort of a very mechanistic study, but it works on the premise that we know that for many young children or children on the autism spectrum, they have difficulties with tolerating uncertainty. Certainty is something that I think everyone has had to learn how to deal with in the last 12 months. Absolutely, the unknown and the uncertain environments that we're all having to live through at the moment. And for some individuals, not just individuals on the spectrum, uncertainty is a really challenging thing to deal with. And it's kind of a mechanism called intolerance of uncertainty. So where uncertainty can be perceived as very stressful and causes quite significant distress and worry. And we think that for individuals on the spectrum, that this intolerance of uncertainty is actually one of the key mechanisms that lead to anxiety in later in life. We know that individuals on the spectrum have incredibly high rates of mental health conditions across their lifetime. So the premise of this new grant that I'm working on is whether we can evaluate therapy that might help to tackle this mechanism really early. So we're looking at, you know, really young kids for aged 4 to 7 who are starting to show these symptoms, that they're just emerging. They're not quite at clinically significant levels yet, but they are causing concern or distress. And instead of working with children, the novel aspect of this therapy is that it's parent mediated, which means we actually work with parents, not with children. And we empower parents to learn strategies to help support their child so that when they are faced with uncertain environments or situations, they can help manage and support that child to help deal with that anxiety. And the premise of this intervention is actually about working with children early in development so that we may be able to help not just reduce their anxiety symptoms or worries now, but actually potentially prevent later disability later in life by helping not just support them now, but also empower their parents to help support them over the course of their childhood.
Any interim findings or is it too early?
Oh, we've just started. So we just literally started this week. But the research is actually based on a therapy that was actually developed in the UK by our collaborators at the University of Newcastle. So this intervention does have preliminary evidence for children on the spectrum, age 6 and above, and in adolescents, and some emerging evidence in young adults. But this is the first time that we're actually developing it for a really younger age of children and really focusing on how do we empower and support parents at this really early developmental stage to then support the later development. So there's some really good, strong emerging evidence that this might actually be really beneficial in not just supporting intolerance of uncertainty in children, but also in parents, because we also know that parents struggle with this as well. And so we might be able to have a sort of a bi-directional effect in supporting both parents and children's mental health.
That's excellent. Gail, we've talked about your research, which you carry out as part of ClinyKids, which is Telethon Kids Institute's first team investigating world-class research with clinical services. How do you and the team go about translating your findings into practice?
So ClinyKids is actually a really new model for our institute, and it really came about because the head of our research group, Professor Andrew Whitehouse, you know, a couple of years ago, we were sort of talking about how we were doing all this really great clinical research, but that there was this really well-known and substantial gap between publishing research data and disseminating it, and when it actually gets into actual real clinical practice for benefiting families and children, which is what we are doing this research for, you know, this really large gap was just not good enough, because of course we work with children, and by that point those children are already adults, and it's just not good enough for us to be developing these new therapies, talking about them to families, and then not be able to offer them. Right. So we decided to, I guess, evolve our research group to not just be a clinical research group, but to actually develop a clinic where we could offer these new evidence-based interventions to our clinical community here in Perth, but really importantly, to train clinicians both here in Perth and nationally. So we do our training over Zoom as well, so that families are able to benefit from evidence-based interventions as soon as we have evidence that they are going to be effective for some children. So the other part of our model is, as we're discovering new evidence or we're investigating new projects, we are able to offer it to our families coming through our clinics as part of their routine clinical care. So when families come through who are presenting with different clinical concerns, that we can offer them a range of different clinical trials for them to be part of as part of their usual best practice care. And this is something that's quite new. I mean, it's something that you see a lot in clinical research in other fields of medicine, but it's something that you don't really see a lot of in autism or just generally in psychological research. And it's a shame, because it means that families might be reading about new evidence or new research, but have no way of accessing it. So we really hope that this model of integrating our research into clinic and also providing a mechanism to train other people as soon as we know that there's evidence to support those interventions will then mean that not just families in our local area can benefit from our research, but everyone who's able to access that training can then have access to that intervention. And we know in Australia in particular, we have huge disparities between access to healthcare in our regional and remote areas. We're a huge country. So by designing our clinic to be able to provide training and clinical services, both through telehealth and through virtual training, we're then enabling more families to get access to the most evidence-based healthcare.
Right. That sounds so important. Is it something happening globally, would you say?
I mean, we're certainly seeing more of these research integrated clinics being established in, at least in the field of autism, across the world, but these are areas of privilege or big cities. And part of what we understand here in Australia is that there's huge disparities in access to healthcare. And so we hope that this will be a model that people will see and hopefully try and consider how these models could be adapted in other settings around the world. And we also know that the evidence for autism interventions is actually still really early. I mean, we recently published a really big policy document, so an umbrella review for our government around the current state of autism intervention evidence. And actually, the majority of it is still at really like early or mixed evidence for its actual efficacy in supporting developmental gains across a range of different domains like language and cognitive and functional. So we need more of these larger integrated research clinics that are collaborative across a range of cities to actually push the state of evidence or the state of science further, because we're really at an unacceptable state. I mean, the majority of evidence at this stage still comes from things like behavioral interventions like ABA or applied behavior analysis, and we know that the state of evidence for that is actually quite poor, but it's the largest body of evidence that we have so far. So we really need more of these types of clinics to start evaluating autism science at a higher level of evidence.
Right. So it's not just about clinical translation. It's also about influencing policy and change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a part of our research group is not just thinking about how we influence clinical practice, but it's really important about advocating for policy change at our government. So we have very strong links with national disability provider in our government here in Australia, but it's around trying to change how disability services are funded and supported, because we need to tackle service delivery and improvement across multiple different areas, so not just at our local level but at a government level and at a national international level.
Mm. Are you optimistic that that type of change will happen?
So I've been here in Perth now for 6 years. this change that I've witnessed in this in the field has been staggering. Like, we're exponentially increasing the numbers of trials that people are proposing and working on. The quality of those trials are getting better. We're definitely making huge progress. It doesn't mean that there isn't still enormous room for improvement in our field, but the last decade has witnessed a really transformative shift in the way that we conduct science in this field.
That's great to hear. Gail, is there anything else in the pipeline that you'd like to mention?
I guess the only other thing that we're really committed to in our research group is dissemination to the community, because too often, I guess, our research sits within the scientific domain, and we have a really core mission around dissemination, really short videos, which we call Second Science. And so they're videos that we do where we try and explain a recent autism paper that either we've published or mostly it's other people's work, and explain that in language that we think that the autism community can understand and that can ask questions or provide feedback of studies that they'd wish us to review and provide feedback on. So if anyone's really interested in the research that we do or interested in understanding more about autism science, I'd encourage them to kind of find those videos by looking up Telethon Kids Autism Research on YouTube or Facebook. The best way to find it is through Facebook. So we're called Clinic Kids Autism Research. And we also have a Twitter handle, which is Clinic Kids AU.
Finally, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
So my takeaway message from this research that we started talking about at the beginning of this conversation is around birth order and family size, and that these are, you know, one of many different factors that can contribute to the enormous variability in clinical presentations for children on the autism spectrum. And so this research doesn't tell us anything about, I guess, the individual in a family, but it does provide clues to, at a populational general level, about one potential mechanism that might underlie these differences. And again, really underscores the importance of us understanding the functional abilities that individuals can present with, so that we can provide them, you know, the appropriate supports that they need to achieve their potential.
And that was published in the JCPP in November 2020, wasn't it?
That's right.
Gail, thank you ever so much. For more details on Dr. Gail Avaris, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.